take us into mice and genetics.
Greetings. I'd like to thank Takao very much for putting this symposium together in MFAR, because it was not too long ago when I think we had to wear disguises and sort of walk around and not disclose our interest in the cerebellum. So I'll take us to the mouse after Catherine's great introduction to the human. And I think we'll stay there for a bit, but bounce back and forth. Let's see. Okay, so in addition to going to the mouse, I'd like to take us also to development, sort of the two issues, an issue that that Catherine raised. So the cerebellum has a very prolonged period of development, which starts in the mouse at embryonic day 11 as a thin neuroepithelium, and then rapidly expands over the prenatal period to produce a small onlogeth that you see the beginnings of foliation at postnatal day zero. But it grows to about 21 days of age in the mouse, or 2 to 3 years in the human, the latest developing structure in the brain where neurogenesis is still going on, and active axonal outgrowth and synaptogenesis between the granule cells here and, of course, the Purkinje cells down here as the parallel fibers. So one observation one could make is that in this protracted developmental scheme, you can have many disruptions, such as the syndrome Catherine was talking about, or as Joe Gleason and Bill Dobbins have nicely demonstrated in Dandy Walker syndrome or Joubert syndrome, where the disruption in terms of function is so dramatic, but almost without fail, there, if you look very closely, symptoms associated with autism. Right. So developmentally, the cerebellum really sits at a way station between incoming information and outgoing information. Interestingly, as we think of it as a motor structure, it actually comes from the alar plate, which is a sensory structure, and it has all the hallmarks of a sensory structure and processes of information, and then through its connectivity connects the rest of the brain to the cerebellum in what we'd like to think is orchestration. So early on in my sojourn into looking at the function of the cerebellum, we thought that one way to go about it was to use some of the neurological mutant mice that Dick Sidman and his colleagues, like Pascal Rakish and so on, had developed. And one particular one that was interesting was the Lurcher mutant, which Jin Zhou and Nat Heinz's lab identified as the GRID2 or the delta glutamate receptor. Because the animal, and this is a normal cerebellum in the mouse with its nice 10 lobules, if you stain it with an anti-calbintin antibody, it demonstrates the Purkinje cells beautifully. And as you can see in the Lurcher mouse, almost all Purkinje cells are lost. So this animal is ataxic, and some other features of the animal are shown here. The identification of the gene, as I mentioned, its relative specific expression, it's a gain-of-function mutation, and it's cell intrinsic, as shown by several individuals. So the idea would be that this animal model is, for looking at cerebellar function, has some drawbacks in terms of motor issues and things like that. So what we thought we'd do is go dig back into a repertoire that I'd learned actually at Harvard, at Children's Hospital, from Dick Mullen, and that is making experimental mouse chimeras. In this manner, we could take a Lurcher embryo, let's say in white here, and a wild-type littermate congenic embryo, shown here in black, and fuse those embryos to make a chimeric embryo of wild-type and Lurcher mutant cells, transplant it into a pseudopregnant female, and get out chimeras, no two of which are the same, which is often said about autistic individuals. So this is what it looked like from the wild-type situation, again, stained with calbindin and crassel violet, to the lurcher, we'd get all manners of chimeras and in between, from not losing too many Purkinje cells, as shown here in higher magnification, to losing many, many Purkinje cells, shown here as big gaps between chalbidinin-positive Purkinje cells, to, of course, the lurcher. And in this manner, we created a whole spectrum of animals with varying losses of Purkinje cells. And the graduate student in my lab at that time was Lauren Martin, who we decided to take this up, and Lauren's at the meeting today. He's stuck with autism research. It's very cool. And we connected with two researchers at the University of Memphis. First, Guy Middleman, a behavioral neuroscientist, and then Chuck Blahaw, to do the studies that I'm going to describe. But interestingly, the first studies that we did showed that the wild-type animals shown here were no different than the chimeras shown in the crossed bars in terms of rotor rod performance. Okay? So the small decrements we would see in rotor rod would be to chimeras that had 90% or greater Purkinje cell loss. But if there were less than that amount of Purkinje cell loss, they performed on typical motor tasks equivalent to wild-type animals and compared to the lurcher performance with the obvious motor ataxic component. So then the idea was to start interrogating the cerebellum in this model system in terms of how it might play out in terms of a higher function. So we did two sets of tasks. This is Lauren's, which was to look at stereotopy, a progressive ratio operant conditioning task. These are meta-associate cages, and where they learn to bar press for reward, and then you stop that reward, and you look for a break point. And mice typically, as other rodents, as humans, will stop pressing when reward is no longer contingent. And in this situation, as shown up here in the left-hand corner, I think you can see that, that the wild-type mean for the breakpoint was somewhere between 50 and 100 trials, although some animals went higher than that. Lurchers showed the most sense, probably because of the effort it took to bar press, giving up even sooner. But chimeras, in general, had a breakpoint that was much higher, significantly higher, than that of wild-type or lurcher mice, for that example. And if one plotted it out between the amount of trials per chimera for breakpoint and total Purkinje cells, you saw an inverse relationship with the most Purkinje cells, fewer Purkinje cells, the highest breakpoint in a linear fashion going down to the most Purkinje cells where they were like wild types. So here we have a sense of a cerebellum's role in an autistic-like behavior, such as perseveration or stereotopy. The next task was done was in Guy Middleman's lab by Price Dixon. And here a mouse learns to get reward, which is condensed milk. He sets up the task by nose poking, and he's supposed to pick the proper case of whether it's a plus or an X. He picked the plus, and this case gets rewarded, and he's drinking his reward, and there'll be a 5-second delay until the task gets reset. Walks around, resets the task with a nose poke, and this time picks the X incorrect. Screen goes dark, and as he comes forward, there will not be any reward. This is a highly involved task, one might consider a cognitive task, of behavioral flexibility, okay, something that is known to be deficient in autistic individuals. And what one finds is you do the reversals, that after the first of all, learning is typically not impaired for the animals, for the chimeras, but in lurchers, it's severely impaired, not shown here nicely, Here, no difference between chimeras and wild type, while major learning deficits or errors in the mutant animal. But as you go through the reversals to reversal 3 and 4, there emerges signs of behavioral inflexibility as the perceptive errors stay high in the chimeric mice and decrement in the wild type mice. More recently, as unpublished data, Price has taken the FMR1 mouse, which, although no one's characterized it in terms of Purkinje cell loss, has a small diminution of Purkinje cells as far as we can tell. But here he finds a similar phenotype in the FMR1 mouse, drawing maybe an intersection between what might be a cerebellar deficit. And this just shows some examples of varying amounts of Purkinje cell loss with, again, Calbinin staining and Purkinje cell counting, and showing the relationship between, in this case, the learning errors and numbers of Purkinje cells. So this took us to get to some of the circuitry that underlie what Catherine showed us and alluded to in terms of the cerebellar influence on subcortical structures going to prefrontal cortex, either through the pontine nuclei or the thalamus. and Chuck Blaha is an aficionado of using electrochemistry, that is, putting in probes that are sensitive to detection of dopamine and glutamate. And we wanted to test the dopamine hypothesis that that has been identified as maybe a key neurotransmitter-involved agent in autism at the level of prefrontal cortex. Much to our surprise, when Chuck did this, the measurement in wild-type cerebellum from the stimulation of cerebellum and looking in dopamine release in prefrontal cortex, you get this nice efflux that is almost eliminated in the Lurcher mutant mouse. If you do the stimulation, because as there's no Purkinje cells, maybe that's not surprising, but if you do that same stimulation in the cerebellar nuclei, particularly the dentate, you recapitulate fairly well this decrement in dopamine release. So what Chuck and his students began to do was to dissect this pathway with cooling or lidocaine anesthesia at different parts around the pathway to see, and then always measuring a dopamine release at the prefrontal cortex. And what he saw is that if you did if you looked at the VTA, you would find a fair decrement in release in prefrontal cortex, while not that much in the medial dorsal thalamus, and you'd actually get an increase in ventrolateral thalamus in prefrontal dopamine release. But in all, this summed up to sort of all came back, so it was a zero-sum game in terms of losses and pluses and minuses. And this is the work we're proceeding with in terms of building the circuitry that might underlie the cerebellum's influence on at least dopamine release in the prefrontal cortex. And we're putting, you have glutamate sensors also, which can do similar things. That was recently published in the journal Synapse. So sort of to come back to the human situation, following on what Catherine talked about, there's two papers to underscore the role of the cerebellum, prefrontal cortex, and autism from the laboratory of Dr. Limperopoulos, formerly of McGill, presently down below the 49th parallel, where she showed, first of all, that if you looked at a whole host of cerebellar malformations, that there was a spectrum of neurodevelopmental disabilities in these children at a much higher level than one would suspect from just run-of-the-mill brain abnormalities, so to speak. And then she went one step further to show that if you looked at the severity of cerebellar damage and then measured the concomitant cortical shrinkage, that the prefrontal cortex was unusually susceptible to an effect, that is, shrinkage, following and in relationship to damage to the cerebellum. Okay. So this underscored the role of cerebellum to prefrontal cortex, as Catherine has talked about, and also its relationship to autism, and parenthetically reminds me of a comment of a proposal we had to the Simons Foundation, again many years ago, that the connection between cerebellum and prefrontal cortex had not been really shown. Anyway, that's parenthetical. So to go from the behaving animal to the systems approach, we wanted to get at the molecular underpinnings of what might be the architecture for setting up cerebellar development. And in that regard, here's the timeline of cerebellar development, that, just to go over that again. What we did in the lab was sort of, I think in retrospect, a Herculean task, is we did time-pregnant embryos within a four-hour period, so we are very tightly controlled the point of conception. And we dissected out whole cerebellum from embryonic day 12 all the way to embryonic day 19 at 24-hour intervals, and then every 3 days postnatally. We ran these cerebellum from at least three samples per time point on the Illumina microarray chip, and this just shows the quality control and the relationship between the cladic relationship between points in microarrays, and you can see that the early embryonic times cluster very nicely, and the mid-embryonic times cluster very nicely, and the postnatal times cluster very nicely, to give us a reliance both in terms of the quality of the microarray and the clustering that we are dealing with biologically significant data. We overlaid this data on a time course of cerebellar development that I'll just talk about briefly when I show you the database that we established that I think is available without registering, although it says here, you can just go in. And this is a CB Grits database. This was conceptualized in Memphis, Tennessee, hence the term Grits, which stands for gene regulation in time and space. We haven't put, anyway, intellectual property on this, maybe we should. Anyway, what you can go here is you can search the database for your favorite gene and look at its expression over time. There are some canned informatic analyses that one can do. For example, differential equation model looking at onset and offset of gene expression, paraclique analysis, which can look at the patterning of your gene and all other genes in our database, and a parent-child analysis done by three different sets of bioinformatics groups in collaboration with us. And what one can get is a sort of hypothesis testing, exploration, and I took three examples from the CB Grits database. One is neuroexin 1, which is, if you look at the Safari annotation of genes and autism, looking at causal relationships, you have a 1 through 4 and an S syndromic rating, actually 1 through 5. There aren't any ones, I believe. There's twos and threes and fours. And then there's the syndromics. And neurexin 1, I think, falls into the highest category of two. And there are three different probes in the database that looks at neurexin 1 over time. And then if you ask for genes in the paraclique that are expressed like neurexin 1, and we just use this top one as the seed for our analysis, you can see a similarity. Maybe not in amounts of expression, which is shown here, but definitely the uptick and the leveling off of expression here. And the kind of genes that I picked out were some protocoherins, contactins, relin, ZIC1, SEMA5A, all which are have been implicated in their role in autism. So this is one way to proceed. Another way to proceed in the database is to again pick your favorite gene and then link out to that. And this is FOXP2. And see how that can play out. You can link out to mouse genome informatics and look at what the knockout looks like. And here you sound like you're sitting on firm territory because there's definitely a cerebellar phenotype. And then you can link out to the Allen Brain Atlas at various embryonic ages. They have a couple thousand genes in that developmental profile. And you can see back here in the cerebellum at E15 that there's quite robust expression, this is in situ hybridization, in the region of the Purkinje cell plate. Okay. And then the third example is a protocadherin 10, which I'll go into a little more detail, but here's what the front end of the database looks like. Here we have C57 black 6 mice. We also have DBA mice here, just as a dissector to make sure it's not, we would think that the two inbred strains should actually have very similar profiles. And then we have several mutant mice here, the MAF1 null, the PAC6 null, the ZIC1-2 nulls, and so on, that one can explore this database further. You can ask it to give you information about these different bioinformatic tools that can be used, and you put your gene of interest in here, and you search. And what you find out is, as is the case in the Illumina chip, there are typically more than one probe for your gene of interest, and you have to sort of hand curate these. There's very low expression here, and this is a protocadherin 10 probe that has a very robust expression. Each one of these units is on a log 2 scale, so the expression level at embryonic day 12 more than eightfold increases up to embryonic day 15. It levels off during this developmental period and then falls down more towards baseline. So this is a very dynamic a gene and cerebellar expression. Here is that Gantt chart of cerebellar time that I showed, and you can actually bracket the period of time that you'd like and find all the genes that change during that time when protocadherin changes, and you can maybe get family members of genes that get turned on and off. And then, of course, going to the Allen brain, you can see it has a very discrete expression in subregions, interestingly, of the cerebellum. So with this tool, we feel that we can have a developmental handle on all the genes that are emerging from the various projects around the world, such as Dan Geschwin talked about this morning, and put them in a context of, at least in the developing mouse, of how it may format cerebellar development and then play out in a larger framework, as I described, either via circuitry or even higher than that in terms of function. I'd like to thank very much the seminal graduate student in my lab, Lauren Martin, and our co-mentor of Lauren, Guy Middleman, and then Chuck Blayhaw, and current graduate students, Tiffany Rogers and Price Dixon, for the behavior and circuitry parts of the talk, and for the molecular pathways, a group of talented postdoctoral fellows, Thomas and Doug, and graduate students, and then our bioinformatics team. And currently we're working with the Ricken Phantom 5 project to actually do a more in-depth analysis at transcription start sites in genes in this temporal expression in the cerebellum. So I'd like to thank you very much.
No. Yes. Hi, Dan. So the defect is in the Purkinje neurons. I was wanted to ask you, is there any changes in forebrain structures that, you know, since you've got this graded change, do you see downstream target changes that might imply circuitry?
In terms of the lurcher?
In the lurcher with, right. You know, with these chimeras, I mean, do you see graded changes,
right,
or, you know,
yeah,
threshold changes in thalamus or cortex or whatever?
Right. In terms of the cytoarchitecture, that we see no difference in the chimeras. That's of interest to us because the lurcher gene is also expressed in forebrain structures. So it's exquisitely in cerebellum, forebrain, and retina. But at the other levels, in terms of synaptic physiology, it hasn't been detected before, but it really hasn't been looked at that carefully. So that's something that is very much on our plate to do, as you'll hear in the next talk, I think, where we'll use a PCP2 Cre line to specifically knock it out in the cerebellum and leave the forebrain unfettered, I guess, to hopefully answer that question. Yeah.